Welcome to Tonic Boom, a specialist capital markets podcast series brought to you by Tonic, the expertise-led consultancy dedicated to giving firms more. Join our host, our resident Tonic Ninjas, and industry experts as we drop the mic on the hot market topics across high-profile domains such as margin, post-trade, treasury, risk, digital, legal, sustainability, and more. More expertise, more trust, more achieved. Ready for your dose of Tonic?
Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to Tonic Boom. For those tuning in for the first time, Boom is Tonic's expertise-led podcast series covering the hottest topics across capital markets and beyond. I'm Chris Watts, Tonic's CEO and co-founder, and as of more recently, a side-hustling podcast host, and a pretty mediocre one at that. But I'm super excited to be here today to speak about a topic that's super hot and gaining a huge amount of traction across the market. Today's boom is titled Digital Assets, the Collateral Catalyst. Sounds a bit scientific, doesn't it? But don't fret, we'll be sticking to our informal roots as we explore. The goal today is really to chat about how collateral is acting as a critical catalyst domain for digital asset take-up across the industry. So we're going to do this in practical terms. We're going to try and keep any jargon to a minimum and have some fun, hopefully, along the way. Now, the good news is today I have several friends here to help, genuine specialists, all of them from the industry and from Tonic. They all have deep hands-on experience of both the collateral and digital asset domains across a mix of products and firms. Firstly, we have Sam Edwards and Greg Donovan from our friends at State Street. Guys, do you want to introduce yourselves?
Thanks, Chris. Absolutely. So Sam Edwards here. I look after collateral services in the region for State Street and recently head up the digital collateral tokenization work that we're doing in order to bring this to life.
Awesome.
Thanks, Sam. And thank you, Chris, for the intro. Pleasure to be here, everyone. My name is Greg Donovan. I work in the collateral client solutions team at State Street. So anything to do with solutioning for a client's collateral and margin needs in EMEA, the EU, comes my way. I'm beginning to look in earnest at the applicability of the digital asset use cases for our client.
Very good. Thank you, chaps. And we also have Stephen Charnotta, Tonic's head of digital. Stephen, do you mind saying hello?
Of course. Thanks, Chris. So I'm Stephen Charnotta, Tonic's head of digital. Typically work on large-scale business transformation initiatives across a few of our different domains, so post-trade, collateral, and most importantly, digital assets, and currently working with both Sam and Greg on the digital collateral initiative.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephen. Now, before we go too far, we do get the chance to get to know our guests a little better. We're going to do this via the trusted Two Truths, One Lie challenge, quickly becoming a fan favourite at Tonic Boom. So we normally keep this to our industry friends. So Sam, Greg, who's stepping up for this one?
I'll defer to seniority first.
Age before beauty, is it? Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, let's hit it. So three statements for you here. I understand that State Street are 2-0 down at the moment, so we need to see if we can deceive you. So first up, I'm an international hockey player with a team winning a World Championship silver medal. Secondly, I hold a national Grade B motor racing license and held a single-seater track record briefly at Silverstone. And thirdly, in my youth, I spent time as an international ski instructor wearing the red jacket with pride on and sometimes off the slopes.
Wow.
There you go, chap.
Those are big.
So we've got the skiing, the racing and the hockey.
And the hockey. And just remind us on the hockey was...
An international hockey player with a World Cup silver medal.
A World Cup silver medal. Okay.
Is that a current activity or a historic one?
I still play. Yeah. Yeah. Week in, week out.
And international, presumably meaning you represented your country.
Mm-hmm.
So international hockey player, motor racing license, there was a track record. Correct?
There was a briefly held single-seater track record at Silverstone.
They're all similar vein, aren't they?
Highly accomplished. Like mine are nowhere near as accomplished as that.
I know. I feel guilty now, Sam. I feel like we should have spoken about it. Stephen, early thoughts?
Yeah, I think the line might be the motor racer. I can't see with the around the track, really, to be honest.
Just struggling to visualise Sam in a fast car.
Yeah, I can see him in the ski outfit with the hockey stick, just not in the race car.
I'm desperate to jump in because this is comedy gold, but I feel like I could be leading the witness because I know the answer.
So I know Sam plays hockey. So I know that for sure. What I don't know is whether he's an international hockey player, right? That was a big word. International hockey player.
Silver medalist.
Silver medalist, international. Motor, I can believe the motor racing, I think. International ski instructor, yeah. Ski instructor, that sounds fair. I don't know. I think that international word is the key one, Stephen. What do you reckon? Team decision.
Yeah, I'll take your lead on it, Chris.
Yeah. This is only because I'm feeling confident because of our record against State Street so far. All right, Sam, we're going to go international hockey player is the lie.
It's 2-1, chaps.
Oh,
it's 2-1.
No.
What was it?
Stewart's on the right line here. Yeah.
Should have stuck with my instincts.
I have driven a single seater. I'll show you the picture. And Silverstone. But to be honest, wow, they're quick. That was, yes, it was an experience, but I was certainly not setting lap records.
It was the second part of that statement. Very good. Stephen, I'm so sorry. Right, well, you're going to guess the next one. So on to Greg.
Yeah, like I said, I feel mine are less impactful than those. So
they were big.
But comedy gold, maybe.
Somewhat more whimsical. So maybe it says more about my background. First one is I'm a grade 8 flautist. The second one is I am deathly afraid of orcas. Killer whales, like they come onto the screen and I feel sick, I can't look at them. And the third and final one is that I once spent an evening drinking with a member of the royal family and had no idea who they were until someone told me many hours in.
Very good. So, and the first one, did you say grade?
Grade 8 flautist.
Flautist.
Yes, flute player.
I was going to say, just me not understanding the word is probably not the...
I would never say flute player.
Right, okay. Well, I'm well and truly in my box, Stephen, so I'm going to have to defer to you for this one. So we've got grade A flutist, or flautist, as Greg has stressed, petrified of killer whales and drinking for a whole night with a member of the royal family.
Without knowing who they were. I had no idea.
I'm going to go for the middle one again. I think it was the killer whales. I think Greg's a bit braver than that.
Straight in there. No debate.
Chris?
No, I'm wounded. So I'm Sam celebrating before Greg gave the answer. Means.
I'm confused as to why Sam's celebrating. That's the lie. We're 3-1 down, yeah.
I was just trying to throw them off the scent at the last minute, Greg. You've let them head that.
Very good. Great work, Stephen. Would have been 4-0, wouldn't it? That's my fault.
Can't trust the boss.
I know. Sorry. I got ahead of myself. But all right, that was good fun. Very good. How did you think of that one, by the way?
I think the orca one, I had an ex-girlfriend that was deadly afraid of them. And I thought that's a good one to, like, that's quite a plausible thing. They are quite creepy when you think about them. So, like, I sort of understood that, but I'm not rushing afraid of anything, I don't think. And then the other two were just good little anecdotes I throw out from time to time.
Very good. All right, thank you, chaps. That was fun. So, we should probably get onto our main segment, focused on digital assets, the collateral catalyst. Now, conscious that the broader digital domain is moving at pace, intense pace, so much going on. Very difficult, actually, for the rest of the industry to keep up and keep a grip of the latest and greatest, especially when we all have day jobs. So maybe today we should start just with a reminder of some of those recent market updates across the wider digital domain before we actually zoom in on digital assets. Anyone want to get us started there?
Yeah, Chris, I can take that one. I guess digital space is a rapidly evolving area. A lot of key developments we've seen recently across some of the key sort of domains. So AI, crypto, digital assets, all across financial services. So in terms of like some of the headlines we're seeing in AI, a lot of the banks are sort of increasingly implementing some sort of in-house AI assistance. So similar to what you see with like ChatGPT, but actually protecting their own data. Likewise, we're seeing a lot of the firms using things like machine learning to start to optimize some of their processes. So analyzing breaks, fails, collateral disputes, even liquidity to sort of identify some of the root causes before they actually materialize. In terms of some of the crypto headlines as well, we're seeing a bit of a shift here in terms of on the US, a lot of the banks' custodians typically faced a few challenges in holding crypto assets on behalf of clients. The repeal of SAB 121 sort of starts to align that with traditional securities, so paving the way for broader institutional custody of crypto assets. In terms of digitally native assets, there's a real push to accelerate towards these, especially in terms of the efficiencies they can bring to the traditional ecosystem. So we're seeing a lot of governments now sort of leading efforts to issue digitally native government bonds. So we've seen the Treasury come out recently in terms of digital gilts within the next 2 years, which when you pair it with things like digital cash through Finality, sort of, I guess, paves the way for new intraday repo markets. Likewise, seeing on the buy side, digitally native solutions in terms of digitally issued money market funds, eliminating some of the traditional frictions that we're getting with the subscription and redemption processes. And then I think the final topic, which is definitely important for collateral in particular, is tokenization of traditional assets. So especially in the US, we're seeing the CFTC recently advocating for the use of DLT to support non-cash collateral. And this could start to generate some real momentum in terms of collateral use cases. And we're starting to see some of the market infrastructure providers now get involved in some of the large scale POCs, signaling that things like digital collateral ledgers could be soon a thing of the mainstream.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve. Super informative. A lot to unpack. And alas, I guess today we're probably not going to have the time to zoom in on each of those updates, but I think that was a nice, really concise view of the breadth of the digital domain at the moment and the scale of some of the updates that are playing out across the market. Today, I guess, a little bit more focused on digital assets and the bridge to collateral. And I think the last update you mentioned there was the push towards the digital gilts, which is a really nice segue, actually, into our main theme. But before we do go any further, conscious that amongst, I guess, the boom listener base, there's going to be a spectrum of experience and exposure to digital assets. For those listeners less familiar with digital assets, can we explain to start what actually is a digital asset? How does it work?
Yeah, I can take a run at that, Chris. So I think it's worth, rather than dwelling on the technology behind it, let's think about the three broad categories of digital assets that the world is trying to get its head around, right? You have cryptocurrency type assets, right? Everyone knows what Bitcoin is, how it works, how it's mined, how it's traded, how it's a store of value. That's one.
Not sure we all know how it works, but we all know what it is for sure.
Everyone's very excited.
It's all in the news.
It's a currency and it's a store of value in some sort of way alongside each other.
Absolutely, related to something.
Yeah, so you have, let's be crude about this and say, a pot called crypto over there. In the middle, you then have exactly what Stephen alluded to with digitally native assets, which are, in fact, conveying the same rights and obligations on their holders and borrowers. So a gilt. A gilt does the same thing, whether it is published on paper, like back in the old days, whether it's published in the ways we all know today, or whether it's issued in a digitally native manner on-chain, to use sort of modern parlance. A gilt confers ownership of a piece of UK government debt, and it is used for that purpose, irrespective of whether it's digitally native or otherwise. But you are getting established asset classes, gilts, money market funds, beginning to be digitized from their point of issuance, creation. And then you have the third bucket, which is non-digitally native assets that are represented in a tokenized format to allow their use in a quicker manner than their off-chain native form might allow. Very hard to talk about this without tying yourself up in knots.
I think within the parlance, shall we say, you know, what we call as like the traditional twin, which is where you've got a traditional asset, we've twinned it, we've created a, and I know people who are more tech savvy than this get annoyed with calling it a twin or a copy, but I think in an easy sort of manner, that's the way to think of it, is you've got the real asset, we've locked it up in a quasi vault somewhere and created an electronic tokenized version of it on chain.
Yeah. And I think for the purposes of the conversation we're having today, I think almost park and discount the cryptocurrency one. I think all of these, if we look at the digital landscape more broadly, there will come a point of coterminous on these things where they exist in some way in the same ecosystem, if you believe the hype. But I think for the purposes of the collateral landscape we're looking at, let's park the crypto assets, because for the sake of this conversation, I think it's important to acknowledge they're part of the digital landscape and subject to a lot of the changes that Stephen outlined earlier. But I think when we're talking about collateral, there's between $25 and $30 trillion of cash and stock collateral flying around the world on any given day. We need to be talking about digitally native assets and how they can be co-opted into that pantheon, and how tokenized representations of non-digitally native assets can be used in that landscape. Because I think there is enough value in those two alone to make that the focus of the collateral thinking on this topic.
And I think it's useful when we then think back to sort of the topic that we've got set out to us today, the collateral catalyst, which I really like the way you've turned up, because bar the sort of the chemistry that goes with it. But it's how can collateral be that catalyst that takes that traditional twin and adds value to something that we can do relatively quickly. So as Stephen talked to, there's lots of proof of concepts going on. There's lots of first use cases going on across the industry as to how we can generate this. Well, this is then getting us into how do we realize the benefits of DLTs in a manner that can be accessible now, while we're working towards a better understanding of how we manage digitally native assets and how we then get into crypto further down the line, and how is that all going to work together? Because we're going to be in this twin world where we've got traditional assets and digitally native assets for the next decade plus. But equally, if we're not as an industry working towards how we solutionize that, then we're going to get left behind. And, you know, anyone who doesn't get on this journey soon is going to find themselves with a pot of stale assets that they're not able to mobilize in the way that, you know, we can see coming very quickly through the interoperability on chain.
And I think what you've touched on there, Sam, is leading into quite a key point for me, which is, why do people deliver and receive collateral? They do that to prevent counterparty risk building up to a point that puts them in a perilous or detrimental position in the point of default. That fundamental need doesn't change. And I think I'm touching on this because we hear a lot, we're doing digital collateral. Okay, you are settling something in a new manner, potentially, but you are ultimately fulfilling the same need for yourself and your counterparty in doing that. So unless the solutions that are being looked at are doing that in a meaningful manner, it becomes purely an academic exercise. And I think what would be interesting over the next sort of half an hour is how the thinking on those solutions is beginning to formulate.
No, I think that's a great point. And maybe that's the step that we take next, actually. So you guys have really nicely framed, I guess, the bigger landscape of assets or digital assets that exist. And that's that combination of crypto and digital native and then the tokenized assets. And I guess for today, we're probably safe to say we're going to focus more on that third bucket, right? Those tokenized assets. So I think where we should go next is start to unpick, I guess, the key industry challenges that exist today on the TradFi front that naturally open up some of the, and I think this is where Greg was starting to go, the benefits of digital asset and specifically why collateral is this leading use case. So I guess with a collateral lens on it, could we help our listeners start to understand a bit better some of those key industry challenges today?
I'm happy to take that one, I think. So I think going back to what I said a few moments ago, the fundamental need behind delivering collateral, putting up margin, doesn't change, or rather the reason for doing it doesn't change. But I think if you go back to the genesis of people posting collateral, most people posting collateral at large scale is just pre and post the financial crisis. There was a realization that counterparty credit risk needs to be better managed. And there was a series of regulatory changes put in place since then. I'm looking at Sam, who worked at Lehman Brothers.
There's a state where, you know, nobody went bust. What was that? You're not going to see a big bank go bust. Don't need to worry about that. You know, yes, okay, you might have to worry about your small counterparts who, you know, might be a bit riskier. But no, big systemic bank, not happening. Well,
it happened.
We've learned and we've spent the last, you know, 15, 16 years as regulators have sort of pushed and done the right thing in terms of getting us into a better place to make sure that we do collateralize our exposures.
And we could probably do a whole pod series about the genesis of those regulatory regimes of change. But fundamentally, you are required in most jurisdictions to post collateral for a number of reasons. And the actual scope of those has increased most recently with the uncleared margin regimes globally. And what that has done is it's brought a greater number of participants in the marketplace onto the table for a larger collateral requirement than they previously had. So the scale of collateral in the global market has increased and continues to increase. But it's also, we're now coming up to 20 years on from, let's call it the Lehman moment, where counterparty credit risk and liquidity, and hold that thought, because I think that's a key word for this conversation, jump right to the top of regulators and the financial ecosystem's thinking. You know, we're 20 years on from that. The systems of and processes for the settlement of the same assets in cash that you may deploy as collateral have moved on very quickly. And I think the collateral landscape has kept up very well. But I think what tokenization of traditional assets offers is the ability to mobilize, deploy, and change collateral in a far quicker manner. So if you think of, you know, a really simple use case, the markets are moving increasingly to T1. So if I have an asset, a piece of inventory deployed in the market today as collateral, and I wish to sell that for one reason or another, I have a far, far shorter window, like half a day, really, to substitute that for something else. I have to recall it. I have to substitute something else suitable to my counterparty in order to fund my trading account for an onward sale. And I think as we, and we'll pause there, but I think as we go through here, what will become evident is the tokenized use case, which allows you to fulfill your collateral obligation in a legal sense without the extraneous effort of some of that inventory mobilization, is why collateral is becoming the principal first large scale use case for some of this technology.
Very good. Very good. I think that links into one of the points you mentioned there in terms of collateral as a part of liquidity optimization. So that's a big focus for a lot of the buy side at the moment, in-house treasury functions. So a lot of firms might have significant amounts of assets that they can't use for collateral at the moment. So think about things like gold or money market funds, if they're sitting on large reserves, if you can start to tokenize those and they're already eligible under UMR, then that sort of frees up lots of additional liquidity for collateral purposes as well.
Absolutely. Those non-major markets are a key driver, I think, for tokenized assets, aren't they? Is it fair to say, like, because they're all great insights, but at parent level, I guess, we're talking about collateral being a key use case here for tokenized assets because, Greg, you were effectively saying high usage, we're all moving collateral, it's being shifted across the whole market, and there's still UMR jurisdictions going live every year, for example. I think it's India and Mexico. And so high usage, but poor efficiencies. Is that fair, Sam?
Yeah. I think the efficiency aspect is absolutely key, as we touched on. You know, the intraday liquidity sort of drains on the sell side. You know, we talk a lot about the buy side, but the sell side restrictions in terms of their intraday liquidity costs are significant. So moving to a DVD, a delivery versus delivery status, where you are able to instantaneously exchange a piece of collateral for something else versus the give before you get or wait for, hang on, I need to get my US Treasury back. I can pledge them a JGB in the morning, but I'll have to wait till for my US Treasury to come out in the afternoon. Well, you know, all of that means that, you know, and certainly on the unwind of that trade, there's significant exposure. And, you know, these trades being done in good size means that that's something that costs everyone capital. So, yeah, there's that instantaneous aspect of removing that friction. But there's also this massive benefit to the market and the industry of removing settlement friction. So settlement is expensive. It's expensive because not only does it take a lot to actually effect, but it's more expensive. There's a lot of manpower that goes into ensuring that not just a piece of collateral, but any trade is settled. And so the sooner we can move to what is effectively this golden source on the DRT, the sooner we can remove these inefficiencies and challenges. So I think that's why we come back with the question as to say, why is collateral the catalyst? Well, it's post-trade, so it's more manageable in terms of from a regulatory perspective than trying to affect changes on, you know, initial trade. So yes, we're heading down that way in terms of issuance, but we're able to take something that's a traditional piece of collateral that's there already and mobilize it in a better manner. It brings all those settlement gains. So, you know, again, on the buy side, we move a lot of collateral bilaterally, not using our tri-party agents. So we're working with our buy-side clients to move them into a tri-party bike environment. But beyond that, we actually get to on-chain version, create this instant interoperability across silos. So we, you know, we're very much looking at how do we create a new custodial environment where you can do instantaneous exchange across custodians rather than having to do that first settlement to your tri-party agent, for example. So where you're still stuck in, you know, time zones. So time zone, I guess, is a big aspect of it, as well as the DVD.
Awesome. The only other one I was going to squeeze in, of course, was, I think you guys were alluding to it, but I guess the regulatory drivers towards T+1 as well, the recent go live in the States. We know UK, Europe is going to have to hit the same requirement by, I think, 2027. And we certainly know of clients that are looking at the runway in front of them now and thinking, should I be using that time to actually leap over my TradFi operating model into digital and start increasing, I guess, the portion of my collateral base or my total asset base that's settled digitally on T0 near real time. So many drivers aren't there pushing in the same direction. Thanks for that, guys. So we still have loads to cover on this topic, which we're going to break out into a second episode. So for now, thank you again. Awesome insights. And we're going to pick this back up on our next episode of Tonic Boom.
You've been listening to Tonic Boom. Don't forget to like and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest developments and industry opinion across capital markets. Visit thetonicconsultancy.com to see more of our expertise-led insights and end-to-end solutions. Tonic. More expertise, more trust, more achieved.